before Jesus was talking about talents. He was in the temple. And if we remember back 3 weeks, the Pharisees were trying to trap Jesus, and Jesus is turning the tables on them. And then they come to a point in which they realize that they can't actually get Jesus. And so Jesus then pours it on a little bit more. Now the lectionary skips over the next spot, which is chapter 24. We cover that in a different time of year, but that is where Jesus speaks apocalyptically. And the apocalypse is the great revelation. It is not so much death and destruction as the Left Behind tells us. It is about all being revealed, right? And so he's speaking, we call apocalyptically, describing the coming of the Son of Man and quoting from the scripture of Daniel. And with this way of speaking, he warns the disciples of what is to come. Now he tries to get them to understand that the apocalypse is not long in the future. The great revealing is not happening in a long time from now, counted in years. It is counted instead in days. On Friday. And they will have to learn how to endure hardship and persecution. He doesn't speak of the hypothetical of when this may happen or this some sort of intellectual happening point. Just here's what you're going to do. Here are the 12 steps to figure out how to be and what you're going to be doing then. None of that. He describes what they will experience. He talks about what the coming of the kingdom will feel like. Its arrival will not be like a warm blanket. To illustrate the way they will experience it, Jesus describes it as preparing for a thief coming in the night, which we catch as well from Paul. And then he tells these two parables, the bridesmaids waiting for the bridegroom, and then the parable of the talents. Jesus has primed his listeners to hear about endurance and false punishment. So remember in the Beatitudes from the beginning of Jesus' ministry in Matthew, they conclude, "Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." These two parables, including this one we just heard, are instructive of endurance more than they are salvation. When we read Jesus' parables, it's smart to look for the triggers in them, right? Those places in the story that are there to remind the hearer of something. It brings it up. It's like having a memory triggered. Now, we're not always good with these triggers because they aren't for us, because they tend to be things that Jewish peasants under the rule of Herod and Roman authority would know intimately and personally. They would know it from their life. Now, this parable has two such triggers that should directly affect the way we read the story. Now, the first is the master-slave relationship. Now, we don't, I sure hope none of us understands what it's like to be a slave or a tenant farmer in Jesus' era, because then we'd have a time machine, and you can't keep that a secret. But none of Jesus' parables that feature masters and slaves ever make the master look virtuous or good, like the person we would want to be. None of them do. They tend to make the master look sadistic and untrustworthy, vicious and cruel. They're fickle and reactionary. They take what they see and they respond angrily. There is little equality and true mercy in these stories. So they look nothing, in other words, like God. Remember, Jesus tells us to compare the kingdom to these arrangements, right? And this time his words, then the kingdom will be like. But he never says, this is God and this is you. This is what the kingdom will be like then. God is elsewhere in this story. Now, the second is the economic relationship. And this is more obvious when read with Jewish eyes. Now, let me ask you, how do you double your money? How does anyone double their money? What do you think? How do you double your money?
You count it.
You count it, yeah. And then you count it again, and you get twice. That's one way to do it. And there are people who do that, actually. And then they go to jail. Right? But you're right. When you're onto something with that. That's it. One of the things is you take that money, right, and you put it somewhere, and it comes out with more. Right? That's one way. There are other ways to double your money. What methods are required for a person with no personal assets, so they don't have anything to count, they don't bring anything to the table, they're given a big pile of cash, not theirs, by the way, and an uncertain timetable to make that money and double it? The master tells the third slave what he thinks the slave ought to have done. That's a clue. Take it to the bankers. Invest it. Now we're not attacking bankers and investing. Just hear me out. That's where he then uses the real trigger word. Interest. Okay? Some of you know the problem here. The master condemns the third slave because he didn't take free money, invest it, and double it through interest. What is one thing that God's people are not ever supposed to do? Charge interest. So the master condemns the slave for not doing something he is not supposed to do. He does what God would have him do, in fact, and is condemned for it. Right? So this parable doesn't invite us to prosper through God, but see, the kingdom comes with growing pains. That the message Jesus preaches does not reflect our system and our natural tendencies, nor does our system reflect Jesus' message. Now, unfortunately for us, next week is the barn burner, right? Next week's the great conclusion that wraps it all up. So we can't go there yet. That's next week. Gotta save something for next week. But we can stick with what the hearers are hearing in that moment, how they're hearing this story, right? So I'm sorry. Please forgive me. We remember that the frame Jesus has given us is that the coming of the Son of Man is about endurance, right? He's been talking about endurance. Now, is there a character in the story who does endure? Right? Of course, the third slave. He recognizes the master for what he is, an unethical and unscrupulous person. Because we remember that God is the great sower and responsible for all the seeds in the field. God scatters it all. But this master reaps where he doesn't sow. Right? In other words, he steals from others and takes advantage of them. Right? Imagine a farmer taking his or her tractor over to the neighbor's field while the neighbor's out of town, claiming something over here. That's not exactly right, is it? And the master rewards this behavior. Dare we call it stealing? Stealing from your neighbor? That the first two slaves are responsible for. They know what this master is like, and chances are they take on his behavior. Think The Wolf of Wall Street. I haven't seen a movie yet. We don't watch movies anymore. But the culture that's built around stealing people's money. Right? Not just the excess in itself, not just the grandness of living a high life. That's not the issue. But it's the attractiveness of this. Think of how alluring it is to throw away your morals for the opportunity to double your free money. What would you do? So the third slave doesn't go there. The third slave names the behavior. And the third slave is right to fear for his life. Fear that master. I mean, it's an ugly situation, but he isn't corrupted by it. What is to happen to him, like what happens to the temple and to Jesus, is that more powerful people try to corrupt what Jesus in chapter 24 calls the desolating sacrilege, a corrupting abomination, the thing that destroys you. But he stands up to it. Now, our neighbors, if in both directions, if they're following the lectionary this week, they are probably smarter than I am. Right? And knowing that they are inviting members to pledge and give of their many talents to their community, they probably are preaching about something else than what I did. They're probably preaching the multiplication of talents. And that is totally more productive than the sermon you are getting today. And I am so sorry. I'm sure Craig McKee is going, Drew, what are you doing? I'm writing this letter. They're getting out these pledge cards. We want them to actually fill them out. I do think, though, that this parable can help us with talking about talents and money and stewardship and pledging, but in a slightly different way than we're used to. When I asked rhetorically how does a person double her money, it's to highlight that the only way to get rich quick is to steal or double count. Right? Investing takes a lot of time and existing capital. You have to have the cash up front to invest, and then you have to wait as it pays dividends slowly and in much smaller numbers. And intentionally growing requires a lot of resources invested, again, at the beginning, without assurance that it will pay off in the end, just like investing. Or perhaps we benefit from another church's closing or struggle. We are reaping where we have not sown. I think the parable directs us to acknowledge instead that right now, in this culture, in this community, in this time, we're talking about surviving and enduring when things seem to be working against us. It's about hearing what Jesus is teaching us about relationship with God and one another in the midst of difficult times, and calling this work holy, this life good, this moment an opportunity to love and praise God. We do have a variety of talents and gifts and currencies that we are being called to share with one another and with God. That is still a good message to preach, and it is true. But let us not do so with the pretense that we can double our pledges without increasing our own, or growing the church without doing the work of inviting people to join us here, or that we can grow our relationship with God and one another without ever praying or getting together or listening or reading or being in each other's company. Doing the active work of allowing God to continue to form us, to be better tomorrow than we are today, to be closer tomorrow than we are today. That our children will grow up in the church by only learning about it abstractly and without participating in our most important work. Our commitment, our first commitment, is to God. And doing God's great work here and throughout the world. So may we be filled with the grace and hope of Christ. May we be blessed with equal shares of courage and compassion. And may we stand up in the face of adversity and declare our devotion not only to God, but to the better world that God has promised us. Christ reveals to us, and the Spirit provokes us to make happen in the very here and now.